I'm recording now, though, so we can record this chat, this discussion.
Cool.
Timo, you've been in overdrive.
Yeah, dude.
A little bit.
This book has the Constitution along with the summary court case quotes and prints.
Yeah, I just sent you guys a file.
I have it open in PDF.
It has Van Valkenburg in there.
Huh.
It's a pretty awesome book.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at it other than that. So,
Orlando Bump. What does that mean?
Well, you brought up the 3 cent postage, and you know, you weren't privy to our conversations, but Corey and I discussed this a bit, and you know, my understanding is Dane's belief is that the 3 cent got locked in when DC got incorporated in 1871, which those municipalities were already incorporated. They just got incorporated into DC and they kept their names. I don't know what legal ramifications that has in terms of corporations, but Corey, tell me if I'm wrong, but your understanding and belief is that it's just when Congress, de jure Congress, wasn't able to convene anymore, that that ended up locking in what the rate was.
Yeah. Basically, you know, the under the same theory that the United States came into existence after the Articles of Confederation, there was no quorum for the Articles of Confederation, so they did what they came up with the United States without Rhode Island, included Rhode Island, then basically abandoned the Articles of Confederation. But the United States was built on the authority of the Articles of Confederation. And then once the Civil War happened, the same thing. There wasn't a quorum. And they had to create another form of government where the government just became a federal, hologram of the previous government. That's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. In some respects, I could see that happening. In other respects, I would think that if a court was even allowed to rule on that, that they would say that, well, the president and Congress had to do what they had to do to save the Union, and so they could still meet. I don't know if the court would even ever attempt to make a ruling on that. And unfortunately, the Congress has the authority to determine what is the legal government.
Right. But only for federal issues. Congress doesn't have the authority to make what state government is.
Yes, they do. If you look at the Rhode Island case, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, there was the... Oh, what was it called? The something war. The name of the governor in Rhode Island. I think I sent you guys. It's on the base camp thing about shepherdizing. Borden. Something like that. Borden.
What was it?
Basically, Rhode Island never. All they did was modify the charter for the colony they had to, and turn that into their constitution. They didn't throw out the charter.
Right.
And they had that for some time, and then a group of citizens in Rhode Island basically formed their own convention and adopted a new constitution and instigated and had an election and got the governor, which if I remember right was Borden, and started to basically say this is what the government is in Rhode Island for the state. And they called it the charter government at the time. So the previous government, which was the state government of Rhode Island, continuing from the charter, but with amendments and to the charter and repealing certain parts of the English common law and so forth, said, no, we're the de jure government, and they sought support from, I believe the Congress had given the authority to the president, so they sought support from the president to send a militia, and the president didn't send the militia, but he, it was Luther V. Borden, but he did indicate that if there was any outbreak and so forth, essentially that he would support the charter government as the de jure government and not the Borden government, or I think it was Borden, if I'm mixing up the parties. And so from that case, that's when I first learned, oh, Congress is given the authority to determine what is the true government in one of the states of the Union. And that Congress is given that power, if I recall correctly, to the president. So ultimately, the president right now would have that authority.
So does that mean the president, let's say the president decides that the original charter wasn't the government and that these other guys aren't the government, but a couple of his buddies are, that he could just say, now you're the government, and that would fly, do you think?
I think he'd have a hard time having that one fly, yeah.
I think what there must be some sort of contractual arrangement to rely upon that says what is the government that the... I wonder if that decision would really say that the president can decide what the government is. It sounds to me like the president was only recognizing the government that had been established and not picking between the two.
Well, it's been a while. I'll have to read the Luther v. Borden case, and it goes into it in detail.
I just downloaded it. I downloaded it from the thing. That would be interesting to see.
So how did we get on that? So that was about whether Congress had the authority. So Congress has the authority, I believe, to, in the state, to determine what is the lawful government. So I don't have 100% solid opinion yet on... I'm pretty doubtful of Dane's claim, and if I looked up the act that incorporated D.C., basically if I were to try and understand Dane's claim, I would say, show me the municipal charter for D.C. and who ultimately is responsible for ownership and who has liens and whatnot on the municipality in D.C., and how, show me how that influences the post office. So I don't see evidence for it. It's just a claim. So I started seeing...
Why do you think they do deliver it for 3 cents?
I would say the only way that they can deliver it for 3 cents is, I agree that there is some statute that established what the post office would deliver mail for, and I can understand and I would agree that there is this non-domestic and domestic mail relative to DC, and depending on what circumstance there is, how it changed. So I can fathom maybe what Dane says, but I want to see evidence. I can fathom maybe what you claim, but I wanted to find evidence. Because I could equally come up with a theory to say, you know, I don't, there's another opportunity for that to have occurred, and that would have been at the similar time at which birth certificates were being issued, at which lawful money was put into circulation, at which Social Security came out, and at which the 1940 Naturalization Act came out. And I believe, I have to check my notes, but there was a period of time from 55, I think, was there was 3 cent mail up to 3,000 miles in the United States, and over 3,000 miles, I think it was 10 cents. And then they changed it in 1855, I'm sorry, that was 55. In 63, they changed it, and then it bounced around a bit. Even went to 2 cents and 3 cents, maybe back to 2 cents and back to 3 cents again during World War I, World War II. So I have to check the exact date, and I have that. I can look it up here in a second. But there's a huge window in there in which the 2 or 3 cent could apply. So I started looking for evidence that would be present a consistent story between, one, the postage rate, two, possibly the ability or inability to get a passport as a citizen of the several state of the union, and at what cost. As you and I discussed, went and looked up the 1856 statute where they took what formerly was able to any notary of one of the several states of the union could issue a passport, and apparently if you read the statutes, there was fraud involved in that, and they finally in 1856 said, okay, we're going to establish that the federal government's Secretary of State, I believe it was, or State Department, has that authority only now. And it also prescribed in that statute that the cost for the passport should not exceed $1. Interestingly, the statute also indicates if anybody falsely represents someone of the State Department in issuing or even verifying a passport in terms of, I assume, examining it and is not legally allowed to do so, it'd be a misdemeanor and they can go to jail and get fined. So passport and postage and definition of citizen, how can these all maybe line up together? Is what I started searching for. So I thought, well, you know, one of the roots of all these natures, to some extent, was this topic of privileges and immunities. And it's the use of that word in the Constitution, and Constitution 1789, and for that matter, for the states in the Union. And what does it mean? Because, you know, on the show, we talk a lot about rights versus privileges. And today's definition of a privilege, I would say, probably would be significantly different from that of a right. But at the time that the Constitution was written, I'm beginning to understand from reading through history and this book that privileges and immunities was referring to fundamental rights. It was not related to being domiciled in D.C. and being granted a privilege rather than having a right. So if I'm trying to remember as I went through here, I found a couple court cases in, I think it was 1907 maybe, 1900. I'll have to try and bring up which ones those were. One of them was something versus Greenberg, and it was a corporation trying to use the 14th Amendment. And it was recognized by the Supreme Court that the 14th Amendment was for natural persons only. So I commented on that and wanted to get together and discuss that. And Dan,
that's changed because I have a order from Governor Duke Majan that I carry with me, and it refers to the Fifth Amendment applicable to the state of California via the 14th Amendment. And the state of California is a 14th Amendment person. Today, there's a lot of persons that are 14th Amendment persons that are corporate.
So I could not find evidence. In fact, not that I would say I'd 100% trust it, but look up that court case on Wikipedia as well, and it discusses it and says that it has never been, overruled or repealed.
Well, a court case can remain like von Valkenburg v. Brown. There's a lot of decisions on it, and it still stands as good law, but there's sections of it that have been challenged that have nothing to do with the purposes that that I was on it. I'm looking up that letter right now.
Governor who?
Duke Majan. Let's see.
Duke? Is that his?
Yeah, Duke Governor, California Governor Duke Majan.
Duke Majan. M-A-G-E-N?
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to find it.
Heard of the guy. What era was that?
I think it was in the, like, 1969. Hold on. I'll have to search on my computer.
Well, I'd propose maybe a minor activity. Hopefully it would be minor. Would you be willing to write a letter to the governor and say, here's this court case, and please explain to me under what basis that the governor could have made this statement and established the state as a person under the 14th Amendment?
Well, I think, like, if you look at the case, the it's the one that was the People's United case, and that was a corporation looking for free speech. I mean, that was a corporation versus a birth certificate.
Okay, so let me step back. Let me say that both of them are true.
Yeah.
Okay, if they're both true, the case I believe I was referring to was in 1907. I'll have to look it back up. And then the one you're referring to is obviously after that. So if they were both held to be true, unless there's a different detail in the circumstances, would that give an indication that the timeline in which the what we know as the federal government today was established after the 1907 Supreme Court ruling?
No, I think it's this. I think from the very beginning, when they established Washington, D.C., from the very beginning, they had the authority to create a 14th Amendment person. They had the authority to create anything they want in their own jurisdiction. And, I mean, they could create a 87th Amendment person, call it that, even though there is no 87th Amendment person. And the courts would have to find that they're allowed to do it because they have exclusive legislative jurisdiction whatsoever. Now, at the time of that decision you're referring to in 1907, because you're closer to the time of when the founding fathers put the country together and there was a certain intent for putting it in that box and people kind of honored that intent, but it doesn't mean they didn't have the power. So in 1907, it may not have been argued whether or not a corporation could be a 14th Amendment person. But in California, when they ratified the 14th Amendment and basically made everything 14th Amendment in California, it's all corporate, all through the federal government. That doesn't mean the federal government had any new powers. It just means the federal government was exercising power it already had, but hadn't previously exercised. I am looking for that thing. I can't believe I usually keep it with me. I must have given it to somebody.
So, Tim, that case in 1907, was that Luther Borden you're talking about?
No. I'll find it here.
Here's another example. Let's say that it turns out there is a – geez, I'm trying to think of something that we don't regulate right now or that nobody would think of. an example. Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example. It would be like going back to when the founding fathers were around and asking them to restrain federal government against the ability of being able to create a 14th Amendment person, convince all the states to become that person, and then give up their rights and the federal government takes over. I don't think they ever even dreamed that people would want to be, you know, citizens in Washington, D.C. But Washington, D.C., from the moment they created it, has always had the authority to have citizens. It's not a new authority to get to for the courts to recognize that a 14th Amendment person is a citizen of Washington, D.C. That authority started from the very, very beginning.
So you're getting in the weeds with where I think Drew has been, and that's about boundaries. And I think D.C. was given boundaries, wasn't it?
It was given boundaries, but remember – the government of Washington, D.C. is also in every single state. And there's nothing that prevents them from creating an exact mirror image opposite of what the state government was that was there to protect the people. However, the federal government, being backwards, is there to fleece the people. And that's in court decisions. The federal government's already in every state. That's just how it works. But it was never supposed to be the one that you lived in every day. It was supposed to be the one that protected, you know, the state, protected the borders, and performed the functions.
When you say federal government is in the state, was the interpretation when that was ruled upon meaning that the federal government had standing in the state to be recognized in the court, or did it mean that it was
It operated in the state. Forget the court case off the top of my head, but it said in every state there is two governments, a government of like the federal government, the United States, and a government of the state. And when a state, before it entered the Union, the state was responsible for its own defense, responsible for everything, whereas the United States had created a federal government that would provide for the common defense. But the Constitution doesn't say it's not allowed to create its own citizens and have its own, you know, government as big as it wants to be. And legitimately, as long as it's only guarding its own citizens, then it's allowed to have a government in each of the states, which it basically did in California up until 1959. Then, when they ratified the 14th Amendment, they basically said, look, you guys do such a better job, just take over. You can have it all.
So Corey, let me take that a step. The same concept, but the timeline's just a little different. Presume for a moment, okay? Actually, I didn't know about this part of the history. Did you know between the 13th and the 14th Amendment that there was an 1866 Civil Rights Act?
No.
That 1866 Civil Rights Act, obviously established by Congress, created a citizen of the United States of America.
Okay.
And its wording is somewhat similar to the 14th Amendment. All persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States. So I'm sorry, I said United States of America earlier. It doesn't say United States of America. It says United States. And then there are other things in the statutes related to protection for rights. And at least historically, and the debates that took place in it, it appears, if you read it on its face value, that they were trying to establish protection for the blacks who had now become free but were not citizens and weren't being whose rights weren't being recognized or protected by the states. Okay, I don't have a 100% definitive decision on either way, but for a moment, let's assume that that was a legitimate, honorable act.
And well, why wouldn't it be? What would say that the Civil Rights Act could? What would maybe construe to say it's not a legitimate act?
An honorable act in terms of it's not trying to enslave people as being residents of D.C.
Okay. Yeah. No, okay. I agree with that 100%.
In 1866?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I don't think the 14th Amendment was originally intended to be something to enslave everybody. That's not my position at all.
Okay, so bear with me then. Okay, so 14th Amendment, it very similar in nature, and if you actually look at some of the history of it, which I wasn't aware of, the first couple ways that the committee that was put together to draft it, they came out and didn't talk about citizens of the United States. They talked about the state, and the state shall, you know, all persons shall be citizens of the state, and this and that. It was all about state, and it was what the state was prohibited to do to all the people throughout the country. I don't remember the exact verbiage. I can look it up. But then they passed the 14th Amendment in 1868. Essentially, it was ratified in, I believe. And then that 1866 statute remained as a definition of a citizen of the United States until 1940. And the Naturalization Act occurred in 1940, and in, I believe it was 1926, was the first time that they had codified all the statutes and put it into United States code?
I don't know.
And I'm pretty sure that's roughly the right date, 1926. And in Title 8, Section 1, is where the 1866 Civil Rights Act that established what a citizen of the United States was placed in the code. And then in 1940, when the Naturalization Act came out, the Naturalization Act reorganized much of the naturalization rules and so forth. And during that, they repealed that portion of the 1866 Act that defined what a citizen of the United States was.
Whoa.
And then they moved many of the other sections of the 1866 Civil Rights Act from Title 8, if I recall correctly, to Title 42 in the United States Code, Chapter 21. And then they established what's currently, and so in 1940 in the Naturalization Act, what they then put in was what the definition in Title 8 is for a United States citizen, a national of the United States, and so forth. That's my understanding. I have to study the 1940 nationality
well,
or
in
naturalization.
In California, the it used to be that if you were going to be naturalized in California and you were going to become a citizen of California, when California was operating off the Constitution of 1849, all of those hearings were held at either the district court or the county court. And the county clerk was clerk for both courts. Then, and that's when California had a district court and a county court. Then the Constitution of 1879 was pretty much adopted by everybody. And in 1880, they did away with the county court and the district court and replaced it with the superior courts of California. And from there, I've not been able to find out how naturalizations were done in the state of California since then. I can't find one piece of evidence that shows anybody became naturalized in California after 1880. So the my take on that is what the government did was they just blocked the ability to become formally naturalized in the state of California. That it all became a federal issue at that point through really just kind of fooling the people into abandoning those offices.
I believe that the federal government always had that authority, and per the 1802 statute for naturalization, they established how people would be naturalized as citizens of the United States.
Well, California
and
had its
any
had
of
its,
them.
California had its own naturalization, and the Constitution of California recognizes United States citizens as residents of California, and then citizens of California as two different classes of people. That's in the 1849 Constitution. And the, you know, you can find where, what was that, ancestry.com, I think is the source for it. But they cover how people were naturalized in California between 1850 and 1879. Now, they don't mention anything about the, in that stuff, talking about how the California changed, you know, to operate off of a federal constitution, at least that's what I say it is the federal constitution that was already in California. That authority for the federal government to create a constitution in their sphere of government has existed from the very beginning of California entering the Union. It's not a new authority that they got. They just hadn't done it. But for certain, California naturalized its own citizens up until 1879.
I can't believe that that's all.
Well, that's where you go for the records for people for naturalization is you go to the records of the district court and the county court for naturalization records of California up until those dates.
Corey, what's the upside of being naturalized back in that era? What, who would do that and why?
Europeans came here a lot.
Yeah, a lot of people came here. And, you know, the von Valkenburg case refers to somebody rising to the level of a citizen. So it was viewed as a higher level from what I read in the in these court cases. Being a citizen was viewed as a higher level than being a resident. But the Constitution, what it tried to do was raise residents as far as you still got to vote. You know, you got to have all the benefits of being a citizen by being a resident, you know, or the same protections in the Constitution, but that still citizens were considered to be a higher level because of the way I'm saying that based on the wording the court used by saying when one rises to the level of a citizen.
You're talking about a state citizen who can be domiciled in the state rather than D.C.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, Corey, does it say United States citizens who are residents of California?
Let me look up.
How do they differentiate it? Because there's lots of different inhabitants or residents that weren't a citizen of California and may not have been a citizen of any of the several states.
Yeah, I'll get it for you real quick because it recognizes the two citizens. So let's see.
And Tim, while he's looking that up, you know, you were talking about that Borden case, and I need to go read it more deeply, but it looks like the gist of that is that it was determined that Congress had the authority to give the president the authority to determine which state government shall be considered something, and that something is what I'm gray on. Does that mean that the president had the authority via Congress to determine which government was, quote, legitimate? Or
yeah.
Okay, and then we need to define legitimate, and you go down that path for a minute. Does that mean that it was recognized by the federal government, and in what way is it recognized? You know, is it recognized because the federal government's contracting with them or because of the court? I mean, what's the nexus that connects those two, you know? Do you see what's going with that?
The Constitution, but it's been a while since I've read it.
So I didn't hear that, Todd. I was reading through this. Here's a couple of things where you can see how California clearly differentiates between the United States and it says this state. No person, while holding any office under the United States or this state, exercise the office of governor except as hereinafter expressly noted. In other words, it clearly says United States or this state. Shall deem expedient. Oh, where is it at? Where printed land granted by.
But holding an office is different than being.
Yeah, no, I'll get to the part where.
Just showing some macro there that there's a reference to the two
there's
spheres.
A whole bunch of references of the two spheres. Okay, every citizen of California, this is Article 12, Section 5. Every citizen of California, declared a legal voter by this Constitution, and every citizen of the United States, a resident of this state, on the day of election, shall be entitled to vote at the first general election under this Constitution and on the question of the adoption thereof. So, it's clearly saying a citizen of California and declared a legal voter and a citizen of the United States who's a resident of this state, they both get to vote on whether or not they're going to adopt this Constitution.
So here's this is the 1849 version?
Yeah.
So here's my interpretation of that. Citizen of California, that's, I think we're in agreement. Citizen of the United States that is a resident of California, to me, could easily mean citizen of the United States is a citizen of any of the other several states of the Union whose domicile is in another state, but he has a residence in California.
Yeah, I agree. It could mean that too. What I'm getting at is that they're showing two different classes of people, a citizen and a resident.
I agree. Okay.
Yeah. And just because it can be a citizen of any of the other several states doesn't mean it's not a citizen of Washington, D.C. It could be all of them the way this is worded.
Okay, so another argument related to that then. So I agree that it's possible that someone can be a citizen of D.C., let's call it, as opposed to one of the citizens of the several states of the Union, and always could have been that. But the government may not have used that to its advantage, the federal government, until some point in time. The 14th Amendment, when it was passed, and this I would hang my hat on the statements and publications by Thomas Cooley, and probably comes partially from Justice Joseph Story, that says when the people ratify a constitution or an amendment to the constitution, that one of the major things that goes into the quote-unquote construction, meaning the interpretation of what the amendment or constitution was referring to, would be what the people interpreted it to be. So do you think that the people that ratified the 14th Amendment were saying, sure, D.C., you can make any citizen you want, anybody a citizen of D.C. that you want, go ahead?
I don't think the people have that power, because Congress gave at the very beginning Washington, D.C. exclusive legislative jurisdiction whatsoever. They could make citizens that they call ape-faced monkey shit haulers.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
You know, and that's what it is. And the 14th Amendment persons, here's some cases. This is on state-citizen.org. So this is United States versus Cruikshank. This is 1875. We have in our political system a government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. Each of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has citizens of its own. And then in 1883, this one, McDonnell versus the state, he was not a citizen of the United States. He was a citizen and voter of the state. One may be a citizen of a state and yet not a citizen of the United States. Then in 1927, Toshiro v. Jordan, that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of the state. And Kitchen versus Steele, this is a citizen of the United States is a citizen of the federal government. So what you're saying might is likely true. I mean, people before the 14th Amendment, there really wasn't people to think of as citizens of Washington, D.C. They didn't think of them that way. But there were people who immigrated here. And all immigration into the country goes through the United States because they guard the national borders. And when I say the United States, I'm talking about D.C. Somebody could come in and they would be a resident of California before the 14th Amendment, but they're under the jurisdiction of Washington, D.C., because Washington, D.C. is the one that had the laws to bring them in. And once they made it that far, let's say somebody's coming in here from Italy in 1850, they have to first go through the federal government to be able to immigrate here, move out to California, and then naturalize in California. And they could become rise to the level of being a citizen in California. Now, I don't think people looked at United States citizenship a long time ago as specifically Washington, D.C., more that it was, well, okay, you're allowed to be here, but you're not a California citizen yet. You still have to jump through more hoops, so you're not quite the same level, but we give you the same protections. And as the federal government began to mature and collect taxes, and it became more and more profitable to have citizens of its own and to really manage that, and it went from encouraging people to rise to the level of state citizenship to, oh, hey, we got a pretty good gig here. Let's hide this whole state citizenship and perfect our federal citizenship. And the government kept pushing more and more in the courts to define and have control over their own citizens, because it's incredibly profitable in that form of government, to the point where the federal government, from the very beginning, absolute very beginning, if day one Like you have the Constitution for the United States is adopted, and the very next day, Washington, D.C. said, United States citizens are federal citizens. They're our property, and we can tax them on anything they make. And here is a birth certificate that you have to show to everyone. And we're going to give you health care. You're going to have the NDAA. All of that could have been done that day. That power is inherent in Washington, D.C. from day one. But they didn't claim that power from day one. They kind of were working more to serve the nation, which is what Washington, D.C. was supposed to do. And so they didn't define it. And you can see in each of these cases, as the nation has matured, they're always carving out more and more clarity on, no, this isn't what you guys thought it was. This is our property, and the people don't have the power to tell Washington, D.C. it's not their property.
So I agree with most of what you said there. They could do it day one. And I'm not claiming someone who says that they are a birth certificate is not a U.S. citizen. But unless the people ratified the 14th Amendment to say, yeah, that's what United States citizen means, they were just saying, okay, the blacks are citizens of the several states, and collectively they're calling them United States citizens, but they're not domiciled in D.C.
You're saying that's how the people then interpreted what was being ratified.
And I believe that maybe not all, but many of Congress who helped draft it were interested in that, at least from the debates.
I completely agree with you that the people believed that. But back then, I don't think, like, you look at all the people who, Von Valkenburg v. Brown, that woman wanting to be a 14th Amendment person so bad, I don't think she had it in her mind at all that Washington, D.C. had absolute exclusive legislative jurisdiction whatsoever, and the moment she became a 14th Amendment person, the next day the government could just take all of her property.
Now, so let me point something out there. If you read the case, they say there's no doubt that you were born in California and you're a citizen of California and of the United States, but you did not get your citizenship through the 14th Amendment.
Exactly.
So how was she, from the standpoint that you're taking, I'm missing, how was she a citizen of California, one of the several states, and a citizen of the United States, but not domiciled in D.C. and not a citizen of the United States through the 14th Amendment? If she lived to be 200 years old and she tried to vote today and had that case over again, how would that differ?
Well, because there were no contracts to sign back then. There was nothing to provide for that conduit between state citizenship and federal citizenship. The only way that that could happen was looking at, you know, the people who were native born but were not citizens of the several states. They had no nationality at all. And Washington, D.C. then had the opportunity to be able to pick them up into their government, into that federal government. And the states then at that point, and it still was voluntary, but if you were born a state citizen, you couldn't just all of a sudden say, I got my citizenship from the 14th Amendment, because you didn't. Those people never had citizenship. They never were citizens. And so they got their citizenship from Washington, D.C. And the term...
Wait a minute, I'm confused. Van Valkenburg was born in California.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the slaves. Van Valkenburg was born in California. She got her citizenship from being naturally born in California. But if you were in a slave state and you were born a slave, you were not a citizen of one of those several states, and the federal government lacked the power to force those states to confer citizenship on them. They also were not naturalized. They didn't come in through Washington, D.C. They were without a country internally here, and they had no protections at all. And so they became citizens through the 14th Amendment. Von Valkenburg didn't.
I think I want to circle back to Van Valkenburg, but I think that one of the missing links there in that timeline, Corey, might be the 1866 Civil Rights Act. And that could thread be. You just explained, because I've only briefly started looking at it, but and of course on the Book of Knowledge, Wikipedia, which you can't necessarily trust that. You've got to look at the source.
I sent you the act.
Yeah. So, and here's another case that's on that State Citizen, I think this is a fun case to read. It. I read it a while back. It's in 1940. It's fairly recent. It says rights of national citizenship as distinct from the fundamental or natural rights inherent in state citizenship. That's Madden versus Kentucky. The 14th Amendment, I mean, that came out of the federal government not being able to force the states to confer citizenship on people who, although native-born, were not citizens.
Yeah, I'm not disputing or refuting that what that intention was. And I'm just wondering, maybe it was that the Civil Rights Act of 1866 failed. And Tim, I know you sent it to me, and I'm trying to find it. It's email.
No, it passed, 1866.
Right, but what's the ability to enforce it, though, I think, is where I'm going with that. Giving the blacks some kind of citizenship or protection.
Well, so before we go there, just a second, let me go back. I don't think I made my point well. In the Van Valkenburg court case, the court says, undoubtedly, you were born in California, you are a citizen of California and of the United States, but you didn't right. get your citizenship through the 14th Amendment. So help me understand how she is a United States citizen in 1871. 1872. When she was born in California, I don't know how old she was, but when she was born in California,
are you limiting the definition of the United States? Because I don't think the courts have anywhere in there that they specifically say that the United States is Washington, D.C., but she's a citizen of California and a citizen of the United States is consistent with other decisions. I'll try and find it where it says all state citizens have United States citizenship. But the same is not in reverse. United States citizens don't have state citizenship.
Okay, I agree with that. So you think the 14th Amendment didn't create state citizenship. It created a national citizenship. That then gave them state citizenship.
No.
Didn't think it gave them state citizenship.
The 14th Amendment cannot give state citizenship. It's a federal power. The feds created the 14th Amendment to force the states to be able to recognize these federal citizens and give them some protections. But back then when they were creating it, nobody thought, hey, we need to protect ourselves from Washington, D.C., the problem back then were the states. Now the problem is Washington, D.C. And there's no protections for 14th Amendment citizens from the United States, but it's a more complex role now because every state in the Union has ratified the 14th Amendment and runs off of the 14th Amendment. So the federal government is running all the states, and it's just assumed that all the states only have residents and not citizens. And residents are subject to all of the laws, and Congress only passes laws for its own employees. That's it. And residents have to follow those laws.
So let me back up. If Congress is the only people who had authority to make citizens of D.C., I agree. All right? Mm-hmm. And I believe Congress didn't have the authority, and that's why I think ultimately – I don't think it was constitutional, the portion of the 1866 Civil Rights Act where they established, if you thought that when they established all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States, meant that they were also citizens of the several states. I don't think they had the authority to do that either.
Except if they were talking about the states that are Washington, D.C. states, then they absolutely
I meant several states. Yeah, when I say several states, I'm assuming they don't have states means the
they
originals.
They have no authority over the several states. None at all. Courts have said that over and over again.
Right. So that's why I think that part of the 1866 Act, if the United States meant the several states, that it was unconstitutional. But they
do you know Congress, if anybody challenged it?
I don't know if anybody challenged it. That's another reason I want to look through that book I just
may
said.
Not be. Yeah, it may not be like that guy I talked to who's the public policy guy when I was up in Oregon a year and a half ago with my son. He was talking about how they inoculate the public, and if they can get a statute or a code on the books and keep it there for 5 years without anybody challenging it, then everybody gets used to it, and it pretty much will just sit there. Nobody will challenge it. Almost all laws are challenged within the first 5 years. That doesn't mean you can't challenge it 100 years later. It just means
the only way you can challenge it is you have to be it has to be directly affecting your rights, and you have to take it to court.
Right. It has to be something that affects you. And
right.
And all of if you're a United States citizen, the way the system is set up, you don't have any rights. They're only applying these rules to the government workers, which is contractual. And
no
voluntary.
No standing for you.
Yeah, no standing.
I agree. I think we're in agreement there, Corey. So let me take us the next step then. So the Congress could create any citizen for D.C. and the federal states that they want. They did not need any approval by the states.
No.
Several states.
Right.
So, but the only authority that can create an amendment and not propose one, but put it into effect in terms of ratification were the several states of the Union with regard to the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
And if the people of the United States, or so this is a, I guess this is a question I haven't thought of, was it the people that ratified it to create a citizen of the United States, which was in D.C., which you just said earlier, they don't have any power, only Congress does, or was it the people or the states that established the 14th Amendment to have citizens of the United States, which means citizens of the several states of the Union?
The 14th Amendment, all it did was restrict the several states from discriminating against 14th Amendment citizens. That's all it did. It gave them some basic rights that you have to treat them like the lowest level government worker from Washington, D.C. Ultimately, you have this is our property and you're not allowed to beat it anymore. That's what the 14th Amendment
is. I agree. They prohibited them from doing that. So now if you go to the...
Equal protection, baby.
But if you go to that court case, go to that court case in 1883 that I sent, does it not? Did I misinterpret it?
What's that court case, Tim? 1843?
I'm looking it up just a second. It's the Civil Rights Act. Civil Rights case of 1883. Just a second, I don't know what the name is.
Western Turf?
Yeah.
Association versus Greenberg?
Yep, I can't find it in mine yet.
Civil Rights case, 109 U.S. 3, 1883. And here it is right here.
And it's in the email is probably the easier place to find it, but in that case, it says, if I interpret it right, so you had basically some whites discriminating against blacks, and the whites, when they were discriminating, would do it in terms of a private activity where they weren't, well, it was arguable. Some of them were like an inn or something, and there was argument whether or not that was public and so forth, and whether or not the blacks used the 14th Amendment to say, hey, that needs to protect us.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I got to log in just a second.
Yeah, I got it pulled up. I just put the link in Skype for you there, caselaw.lp.
Yeah, but I pointed out in the email I sent.
Oh, okay.
Part of the case.
Well, there's one glaring thing about this one that is the link in there. It says no counsel for defendants. So they had no representation. And if these guys were kind of like, you know, Tennessee hick guys, they may not have objected to things properly. And I'm learning that in this debt collection business, that there's a ton of bad case law out there.
What makes a bad case law? What do you mean?
Well, there's one case that all the debt collectors use, not one, there's actually dozens and dozens of them, that they all use to show that they have a permissible purpose to pull your credit as soon as they buy information from a bank that says, you know, you owe the bank money. And if you really follow that case and then search the other cases for it, you find that even one of the judges in one of the cases said, well, the defendant failed to object, so it stood. And it's really just bad case law. And as soon as you point that out, what the defense is for these debt collection agencies to pull credit, and that you know that the case law they're using is wrong, and you're able to point out how it's wrong, they have no case to stand on, and they won't take it to trial. But
the evidence of that is in the record, that the judge admits that the defendant did not object.
Yeah, let me log into my thing at the office, and I'll pull this argument that this guy Paul that I met, he actually used this argument in court and ended up getting the company to pay a $7,000 settlement to him.
And the reason that this is important, though, is because what? How does this circle back to what Tim was talking about?
Well, because this case right now, I'm looking at where it says, I mean, it's just, it doesn't mean anything. It's just something to pay attention to in the case.
Okay.
It says no counsel for defendants Stanley, Ryan, Nichols, and Singleton. And then later I find that what they're charged with was things like failure to, or they were discriminating against somebody for not giving them a seat, things like that.
He's not saying that there's nothing wrong with the case. He's just saying be aware that
now these guys could have had, they missed an objection, that all they had to do is object to something really obvious, like maybe they're a state citizen. I'm just throwing this out there. I have no idea if this is a reality as far as an argument, but let's say they're state citizens and the federal government is coming in, and all they had to do was say, this is the wrong jurisdiction.
So I don't think it applies here because they won. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know they won. Okay.
They didn't lose. They won.
Holy mackerel.
When you say they, who's they, Tim? What do you
mean? Okay, so the whites that had discriminated against the blacks were the defendants, I believe. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially won because the court said that the 14th Amendment was there to prohibit the states, not the people, not private citizens, the states from discriminating against.
Yeah.
14th Amendment citizens.
Right.
The federal government could contract with the state to have this relationship about their property, but not the people of the state.
Right. And so, in essence, it was dismissed. It said, yeah, we can't do anything about it. They were acting in a private capacity, and it's the state's responsibility to protect them. Now, I don't know if the blacks didn't go further and try and sue the state and then eventually take the state to court for not providing them for protection. That's a different case than to sue the individual directly. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the judge claims in his so I think it was eight people were of the opinion that I'm going to read, and there was one dissenting judge. And a key point that he says, and maybe I'm reading something into it, so I'm welcome for your input, and it's in the email that I sent on November 5th, and in that case it says, quote unquote, the first section of the 14th Amendment, comma, hyphen, and actually this is from case law, so I need to look it up in the actual one that I downloaded from HathiTrust, which is a United States report. Says the first section of the 14th Amendment, comma, hyphen, which is the one relied on, comma, hyphen, after declaring who shall be citizens of the United States, comma, and of the several states, comma, is prohibitory in its character, etc. I interpreted that to say the 14th Amendment said who's going to be citizen of the United States and also being citizens of the several states. Maybe I'm reading that wrong.
So you're saying that in the instance where the blacks who were the aggrieved party for being discriminated against, if they were a 14th Amendment citizen, they were a citizen of the several states, and as a citizen of the several state, even though they're potentially also property of D.C., they should have had their rights protected, and the whites should have lost this case.
Well, let me ask you this then. Can you be a citizen of D.C. and a citizen of the several states?
Yes. But you can't – it doesn't – you can be a citizen of the state and a citizen of Washington, D.C., but that doesn't necessarily mean if you're a citizen of Washington, D.C., that you're a citizen of one of the several states. If you're a citizen of one of the several states, you automatically have citizenship in the form of tenancy in the – you know, the entire in the Constitution in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so let's call it a D.C. citizen. Let's call it a citizen of the state, and then let's just call it through the citizenship of the state, you have protections from the Constitution.
Okay.
Of the federal Constitution.
Federal Constitution.
Right. So flip it back to the aggrieved black who lost the case.
It says, the judge says, well, essentially 14th Amendment makes them citizens of the United States and of the several states. So what do you think that means?
I find it difficult to Washington, D.C. has never had the power to say to the several states who will be their citizens. And so maybe somebody, I don't know what is the time frame on this
1883 15 years after, you know,
what you'd need to do is to shepherdize it and find out who's referenced it and what has happened to that, because just because they say that doesn't mean that it continues to be, that portion of the law continues to be valid. But who knows? I mean, I don't see how the federal government is able to force the several states by creating a 14th Amendment person, force the several states into,
They didn't. The states said, okay, 14th Amendment. We vote on it. Okay. We ratified it. The blacks are citizens of the state, several states, which are the United States.
Yeah. Okay.
I could be wrong, but
I think that's all that's happened. Is you look at today, like to me, there's no issue between a state citizen and a 14th Amendment person. That's not a problem. You're a citizen of both.
I'm sorry. Say
what's happened. To me, I have no problem with the concept of there being a citizen of both. If the states agree that, hey, if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, you're also a citizen of the state.
Of one of the several states?
Yeah, of one of the several states. But that doesn't mean that eliminates from the picture the possibility of there being a 14th Amendment person who is not a citizen of the several states. In other words, okay, so yeah, you are a citizen of the United States and a citizen of the state. But that guy over there, he's just a citizen of the United States. I don't think you can make that leap off of this case, that it precludes the possibility of there being citizens of Washington, D.C., and those citizens not being citizens of the several states. And if you add the complexity of government, like just kind of observe what it's done from then until now, now what it is, I mean, I don't know anybody who has any evidence that they're a citizen of the state other than people who are, you know, very active and they, you know, are establishing that.
That I agree with because of birth certificate and all that.
Right.
So I think what you're saying is the states thought, you agree the states were believing they were ratifying that anybody born in the United States, any of the several states, would be a citizen of the several state, and a citizen through that have citizenship with the Constitution.
Yeah.
But if they were, what you were saying is nobody thought about it, but if you were born in D.C. in 1880, that you would have been a citizen of D.C. like today, a statutory, or not, the, what you were saying, a 14th Amendment, who's not a citizen of the state.
Right.
Of a several state.
Right. And that today they have the same thing, that basically you're just a 14th Amendment person domiciled in D.C., the way they've gotten everything set up. And so you're a resident in any one of the several states that the federal government runs under the 14th Amendment.
Wait a minute, let me back up. I thought we agreed that the states could not state who could be a citizen of D.C. They don't have such authority.
Well, I never said that.
I don't think he was interpreting that.
That's not at all what I was saying. If somebody becomes a citizen of Washington, D.C., for whatever reason, and they're only a citizen of Washington, D.C. in 1883, then they're a resident in any state that they go to.
Yeah, okay. I understand that. I'm sorry. Right. I'm not addressing that. I'm not making myself clear. Earlier we talked, and I think you made the statement, the citizens of the several states had no authority to try and tell Congress that they could or couldn't create any citizen of D.C. that the Congress wanted to do.
Right.
So through the 14th Amendment, how can any of this of the people who ratified the 14th Amendment have, through that as an instrument, created a citizen of D.C.?
Because they delegated the authority.
It was already there. They just said, we'll use it.
Well, how could that question begs the other question, Tim? How can the federal government do anything at all? Well, that's because it was given consent to through the amendments to the Constitution. It was given some, you know, selective authority. You know, it was, and I mean, I'm sitting here. It's funny. This case is word art. I'm looking at it. I mean, what you emailed me. So of course, it's not the U.S. reports, but. You know, they are this verbiage reinterprets the language of the 14th Amendment. It doesn't cite it verbatim. You know, it uses the word after declaring who shall be citizens of the United States and of the several states. That term of the several states is very distinctly different than what the 14th Amendment reads, which says are citizens of the United States and of the capital S state wherein they reside.
Yeah,
the word several states isn't even used.
This is what I'm trying to bring up. So the people ultimately created the national government. The people gave the Congress the authority to do whatever they want to do in D.C. I agree. Okay, we have the authority if we collectively stood up, and we could change that, and however we would want to.
I don't agree that we have the authority to change it. That's their government. We're not allowed to touch it, and they're not allowed to come into the state government. What's happened is today's world, we've all. Through word art and laziness and just kind of the way everybody does things is we're all in the federal government everywhere. It's all federal government. And the federal government maintains to this day exclusive legislative jurisdiction whatsoever. Getting out of that, it's not like it was a long time ago because they don't want to let go of it. They want to keep this what they have.
So let me see if I interpret what you're saying correctly. The people have a contract with Congress, and they gave them exclusive jurisdiction whatsoever, and there's no remedy in the Constitution. The people cannot amend the Constitution to say, no, we're going to curb that a bit. We're going to change that.
In the same way that the people can't go in and tell Texas, your borders are now going to change, or we've just decided that Texas is not going to exist anymore, so we don't like what you're doing. We're going to carve it up and you know, divvy that state up amongst some of the other states. There's no authority to do that. The people can't go in and do that. Washington, D.C., once it was created, it became a very unique place on the planet. And there's only three places like that that I'm aware of. And once that happened within that jurisdiction of that 10 square miles, they can't do anything. Also, within the jurisdiction of Washington, D.C., in their own state, once they enter the Union, you can't touch that. But they're not supposed to touch each other. Those two states are supposed to remain sovereign and independent of each other. So the federal government can't do anything to the state government. The state government can't do anything to the federal government. And there was always going to be a pushing between the two. And then the federal government created this fake state government, got everybody inside that, thinking that they're in their own original state government, but they don't truly have any real rights.
I understand that
area that you're in. I don't see how they, other than revolution, I don't see how you could constitutionally say that the people can now tell Washington, D.C. that you no longer have exclusive legislative jurisdiction whatsoever, unless Washington, D.C. is in violation of its contract.
So I might possibly disagree with you based off something that you argued earlier.
Okay.
Articles of Confederation were abandoned essentially by forming the Constitution.
Or the Constitution was founded on top of the authority of the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
The same thing happened. The event is the same thing, but the Articles of Confederation are still law.
I understand what you're saying. So the people could stand up in the several states of the Union and say, you know what? We are going to form an even better perpetual union, just like we did from the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah.
And we are going to form a new United States of America. I don't know what you want to call it. And this time we're going to create a federal government, or somehow handle Congress or whatever it might be in a much smarter way. And if D.C. wants to stay behind and have a dominion over its territories that they had, well, fine, but they can't do it to the several states of the Union.
I think that's what civil wars are started over.
Right.
It comes down to property.
And are you going to get enough people on board to be able to back that up? They were able to get enough people on board when they created the United States to make the Articles of Confederation to be a moot point. So if you could get enough people on board in the nation to give up their U.S. citizenship, go back to state citizenship, and then organize and form a union that enough of the states are now in, Washington, D.C. could either decide to be part of it or not. I mean, you could seed off another section and say, now, this government here is going to provide for the national borders of our government and do exactly what happened to Rhode Island, and that is simply just starve Washington, D.C. out of existence.
So let me go back to the 14th Amendment again. We're talking about who has authority to do what. So if the 14th Amendment created the 14th Amendment, the people could not have used the 14th Amendment to make any declaration about citizenship in D.C. They don't have authority to do so.
D.C.'s the one that created the citizenship. The 14th Amendment just observed it and then told the states hey, you guys all agree, then we'll recognize these people. The 14th Amendment didn't create the citizen. It was the inherent authority of Washington, D.C. to do it. The 14th Amendment conferred no new rights on the federal government. All it does is observe what was happening and formalizes it on paper.
What I'm arguing about then is the definition of United States is interpreted by the people who ratified the 14th Amendment. So do you think that the people who ratified the 14th Amendment said all persons born in D.C. are citizens?
I honestly don't know what the people thought then. I can say that from what I've read, I think everybody thought it was a really good idea and that it was going to provide kind of a more uniform government. There was going to be a whole bunch of people who were being discriminated against that now wouldn't be discriminated against, and it would give everybody a more equal footing. But I don't think they realized who they were doing this deal with. They were doing the deal with a federal government that at the time obviously had favor with the people because it did a good job or a good enough job to where the people trusted it.
So let me ask you this. Are you saying that the term United States in the 14th Amendment has a completely different meaning than the United States throughout the Constitution?
I don't think I'm saying that.
Oh, I think it's an important question. That's how I've always looked at it.
I think what I'm saying is that there was a difference in quorum. The government had a fundamental change at the Civil War when they created the 14th Amendment, or when the 14th Amendment was ratified. It gave the federal government an incredible amount of power, created formalizing real citizens that they could tax and everything else, and they were going to. And you have one group of people who think it's a very good thing to do, and then another group of people who are the bankers, and they're looking at how they can make a profit off of it. And it wouldn't matter if the 14th Amendment, the term United States, referred to the several states, or if it referred to just Washington, D.C., or if it referred to a building in Washington, D.C. known as the Hall of States. To me, it's irrelevant because the federal government can do anything it wants in there. And if they want to ratify something that says the federal government has all this power and we have to recognize these citizens as citizens that have certain rights, in other words, you can't beat on them anymore, is immaterial to what the solution is today, from my perspective, and that is denying the federal government purse strings, doing everything I can to get into that state citizenship without being a United States citizen, as I know it today, referring to the United States only as Washington, D.C. And that is how it's done today throughout the code. Now, maybe back then they had a lot more leeway on they could word it either way. And if the people intended it to be the United States, meaning the several states, and then the politicians use it and skew it in court as being just Washington, D.C., that's an argument that I don't see how you could win, because Washington, D.C. gets to pick pretty much whatever it wants to do. And the code throughout all the several states now, which operates off of the federal government, for the most part refers to it being Washington, D.C. So that time period of growth of the company, or of the company of the country, from the Civil War till today, Washington, D.C. is going to be pulling for that definition to mean just them, but have you believe it means the several states, because that combination gives them insane amounts of power. You believe you're free? Yeah. And
I don't doubt what they want, yeah. But what you've just discussed, you are relying upon the premise that Congress couldn't convene, so they had to create a new form of government.
Well, I'm not relying on that. I'm saying that that's my observation, and it doesn't matter. Even if they didn't create a new form of government, it's not a new form of government. It's a more refined form of the federal government that has existed from day one. To us, it's new, as far as a state citizenship. I can perceive it as being new, but the federal government, that portion, that sphere of power or sovereignty, has existed from day one of the United States. And the several states still exist, except the several states have all ratified the 14th Amendment to say, we're going to have the federal government perform all the functions and be the organs of government for the state government. So it was that way in 1940 in California. In 1940, the federal government was running everything, but occupying the offices of state government, and then they ratified the 14th Amendment, and that's about the time when the flags changed and things, major changes in California. Well, what do you say? I mean, to deal with it, because I'm looking at, from my perspective, action. And like, for example, my voter registration card, I can mail this from California 1849 to the Registrar of Voters in Orange County, California, non-domestic, tell them I'm not a 14th Amendment person. I don't occupy the office of the 14th Amendment, but I can transact business on behalf of the 14th Amendment. And the foundation for that is my understanding of how things are from the very beginning, and it hasn't changed. The dressing has changed, but the fundamental authority hasn't.
And so let me change that situation. If you were a black man, Corey,
I would do the exact same thing today.
How can you be a state? How can you be a citizen of the several state if you're a black man?
Well, von Valkenburg v. Brown discusses that. The Constitution in California says white males, but that doesn't apply. They referred to that in that case, and there's several other cases where there were citizens of California who were black. That white male thing didn't preclude blacks from being citizens because there's lots of cases where blacks were citizens.
Okay, I believe that's – I could be wrong, but I don't see that how that you've interpreted that correctly, because if they were citizens of California, one of the several states, then a black man would have the right to be a citizen in Maryland.
No, because Maryland has its own constitution. Just because California does doesn't mean Maryland would.
No, the Constitution, 1789, says all the citizens through the Article 4, it gives every citizen the ability and right to be, if you're a citizen of one of the several states, you're a citizen of all the several states, and you can move to another state, and you'll have all the same rights that are there, and you'll be a citizen.
Well, I mean, I know it said that, but in practicality, that wasn't the case because, you know, you have people who were black in California that were citizens. I don't think they were going to Georgia and saying, hey, I want to be a citizen of Georgia in 1850. You know, I don't think that was happening.
No, I agree. It wasn't happening.
Right.
But
in other words, you can write it down, but get the several states to force them to do it might be a problem. But if somebody was a black man who was a citizen of California and wanted to move to Maryland, did Maryland's constitution say no, you couldn't? I don't know. I've never explored that. I'm sure stuff like that happened. But I do know you could be black and be a citizen in California.
You know, it's interesting. When I brought up this 14th Amendment privileges and immunity one time with Bob Schultz, because I was just digging into this, Bob literally like dropped everything and got this attorney in California on the phone with me on a three-way call to try and talk me off the ledge of going down the 14th Amendment. And I remember saying, you know, well, this word privilege and immunity is bothersome to me. And Bob, you know, whipped over to Article 4, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. And I was stumped at the time going, oh, fuck, I guess we did sign up for privileges and immunities already, you know. That's why I'm looking forward to reading that book that you're sending, Tim, and getting more into this. But Corey, you just made an interesting point. I mean, after the Civil War, I mean, this was the bayonet. This 14th Amendment, everybody was just war weary, and it was like, we just had a war over this. You're going to do what we tell you. But it's not because it's about natural rights. It's because now we've got our property is coming your way.
And it was done in a way where people wanted it. Like the vast majority of people really wanted, at least from what I read in California, the vast majority of people were supportive of there being more equality and more, you know, more wealth and more, more protections for people of color, that not just white people got everything.
Well, it's kind of like, how's that Article 4, Section 2 been working out for you so far? Not so good. Right, is kind of where we're at after the Civil War. But if you read the Article 4, Section 2, it says the citizens of each state. It doesn't say United States citizens. It addresses the people. And go ahead, Tim.
So if you look in Black's Law, or Bouvier's, maybe both, I can't remember, prior to Civil War, definition of citizen, it says only whites were citizens.
But that wasn't the case. I mean, it refers to it right in von Valkenburg v. Brown, refers to that specific term of white males in California. And it says her constitution still refers to white males in California. But obviously, you know, that's not the case. There are others who are
through the 14th Amendment.
This is before the 14th Amendment. This is before California ratified.
It says
the
black 14th. Man in the Constitution?
No.
He's talking about Van Valkenburg.
Von Valkenburg. They're saying that, yes, the Constitution said, just like the California Constitution today has a whole big section of the oath that people have to sign it, but they don't have to sign that part. There was sections in the California Constitution that said white men only. That was at the very beginning when they first put the Constitution together, but very quickly it was found that, yeah, you know, we can have blacks as citizens as well. And there were Italians that were naturalized. There was, Irish or white, but there were Mexicans that were naturalized and became citizens of California, where they started off as citizens of the United States right after the treaty.
Wait, they started off as citizens of the United States prior to the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, when California became a state. So you have in 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and Mexicans at that time, they could either say, all right, I'm going to go back to Mexico and I'm going to repatriate in Mexico, or they could become citizens of the United States. This is before California became a state. So they became citizens of the United States, were able to participate in the territorial government, and lost their citizenship, their Mexican citizenship.
Okay.
Then when California became a state, they were allowed to vote, and they're not considered white. They only had to have been here for, I think it was 6 months, and they were allowed to vote, and they were allowed to become citizens, even though the Constitution expressly says white males only. And that just because it's written in the Constitution doesn't mean that that's, again, the actual reality.
So is there a difference between that United States citizen pre-14th Amendment and the United States citizen post-14th Amendment?
Well, no, there's no difference in the citizenship. There's a difference in what the states had agreed to do because they ratified the 14th Amendment, saying, okay, we'll recognize these people as, having certain privileges and immunities. In other words, we can't do certain things to them. Prior to that, it was just, okay, are you a U.S. citizen? Well, here's how we do things here. It wasn't a real problem. But to bring the blacks in, into some protections, the states ratified the 14th Amendment. But there's
I would argue that from the 1802 Naturalization Act, that you became, if you naturalized, you were a citizen of the United States or any of them, it says, and then you could domicile in any state and you were protected by Article 4 in the Constitution.
But I think at that time, Tim, you had to have achieved that in something that was one of the several states.
Right.
Physically. In 1802, California
It was Mexico. Right. That was a whole different world.
Yeah, but so that act was still in a force in 1851. So if I came over and naturalized in 1851 and wanted to be domiciled in California,
you'd have to go through naturalization in California. There's records of it. Your court records. You could only do it in two places: the district court or the county court.
And the Treaty of Hidalgo is 1848,
and then it became a state in 1849, admitted into the Union in 1850.
Okay, so
then from 1850 to 1880, the district courts and county courts handled naturalization for California, and then in 1880. I haven't found any information how that changed when they brought in the superior courts, which was the federal government.
Let me see what the Naturalization Act of 1802 said, which courts had to handle this. You're saying that it was different than what was being done in California.
Yeah, that's one missing thing is when the Treaty of Hidalgo made you a United States citizen, if you chose either one, what mechanism was that done through? Was that through the Naturalization Act, or was it like a new mechanism?
It was just part of the treaty. The Naturalization Act would have nothing to do with it. This is a treaty, a completely different method by which people become citizens.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but was that only at the time to when the treaty occurred, or did that
It only applied to the lands covered, ceded by Mexico to the United States under the Treaty of Hidalgo de Guadalupe, or Guadalupe Hidalgo. It only applied to those states, I mean, that land that the United States gained. That's it.
So is it still enforced today?
Yeah. In fact, it was just read from that guy at Half Moon Bay who won a court case to block his land off based on that treaty.
Right. So what you're saying, if I understand right, correct me if I'm wrong, if I was outside the U.S., I was a Mexican or European or something, and I wanted to come get naturalized and do so in the several state of California in the land recognized by that treaty, if there was a court still there, I could become naturalized as a citizen of the United States, not in D.C., but of several state California.
I don't think you could be naturalized because you would be a citizen of your state and you would just move here and have a, bring everything
no,
with
not
you
me.
And just change your domicile.
Sorry. I am a Mexican, okay?
Oh,
or
okay,
I'm
a Mexican.
German
yeah.
or an Italian.
Yeah. You'd have to, I mean, there's all the naturalization records here. You can look them up online and how it was done, how people got naturalized as a state citizen in California.
So you're saying essentially 1802 Naturalization Act did not apply to California.
It wasn't a state yet in 1848. It was just a territory of the United States. It wasn't one of the several states.
I understand that. I'm talking about 1851, 1852.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that there's. It would not apply to the states. It would only apply to as you're coming into the country, you have to go through Washington, D.C. first. That's the first gate. And that Naturalization Act would affect that. Then in the individual several states, they could each have their own the way they wanted. If the states wanted to say, yep, you're a citizen because you qualified through Washington, D.C. naturalization, I imagine they could say that. Or, like in California.
No, they can't.
Why not? It's their state. They're allowed to say, hey, this is what it takes to be a citizen here. I don't see why they couldn't say that.
I don't believe
they may
that's
not
what
have.
It says. That's not what it says in the 1802 Naturalization Act, I don't believe.
It doesn't have to say that. It's just it's like if I'm company ABC and you got certified at company 123, I decide that that's a good enough certification for me. You're certified here. That certification at company 123 was done completely without my involvement at all. There's nothing to stop me from saying, okay, you can be certified over here because you have that. California decided not to do that. I don't know about the rest of the states, but California had its own naturalization. So you could be a citizen of California by going through the process here, but you couldn't go directly the way our borders were set up. I mean, it may have happened, but I don't think you could go directly from Germany and emigrate to California and have California declare you to be a citizen and bypass Washington, D.C. You'd first have to go through that Naturalization Act or whatever the law is for Washington, D.C. Then you could naturalize in California. I'm guessing.
Huh. It's.
I can't find it. I haven't found anything where people naturalize directly into California.
I'm reading the act. Any alien being a free white person may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States, comma, or any of them, comma, on the following conditions and not otherwise.
Or any of them. That's Drew did stand on that. Yeah. Wish I could get that pulled up so I could look.
I don't understand. Like, to me, it's pretty simple. I don't understand what the hang up is.
I think the hang-up is that based on the interpretation I think I'm hearing is that the naturalization – you're saying that in 1851, California had its own naturalization process and that the 1802 Act didn't trump it because the feds can't tell the states who are their states of the several – you know, who are their citizens of the several states. And – California can just say, hey, we like the 1802 natural. Like, if you go through those hoops, we'll take you in too. Right? That's what you're saying. And I think what Tim is saying is that, well, read that paragraph again, or that sentence again, Tim.
The Constitution says that Congress has the power and the authority to regulate naturalization. And the 1802 Act is Congress's regulation of naturalization.
Of course. Yes, I agree. In other words, the several states like California couldn't say to Germany, send us your citizens, and you know, if you don't meet the bar to be able to naturalize through Washington, D.C., you can skip that and naturalize into the several states. Congress has the authority to prevent that from happening. But Congress doesn't have the authority to say, hey, if you naturalize through Washington, D.C., you're automatically a citizen of California. California had the right to say, wait a minute, you got to naturalize with us too. And if you're going to be a citizen of California, you do that at, you know, in this manner. And that's how it was from all the way up until they adopted the 1879 Constitution.
I think in practice that's what happened. I think legally that Congress could have said, no, they have the power, and it says here that either that or they said they have the power and it was incorrect in the 1802 Act, because it says you may be admitted as to become a citizen of the United States or any of them on the following conditions and not otherwise.
Admitted into the United States under the following conditions and not otherwise. So think about that. If you're naturalizing in from another place, what they're saying is California can't trump, this is how I see it, California can't trump what we're saying as a nation on what it takes to get in here. Congress gets to decide that.
I agree with that. But it doesn't say, it says, or any of them.
Yeah. But it right,
doesn't
or
make
any
you...
of them. It doesn't make it automatic that they, if one of the states, let's say Texas, has a standing thing that they don't have do any naturalization in their state at all, that if you make it through the naturalization in Washington, D.C., then you're automatically a citizen of Texas if that's what you want to be, and you don't have to jump through any more hoops. That would mean somebody coming in would be a citizen of Texas, but it's Texas that had the right to say that that's how we're going to do it. California wouldn't fall under that. At least I don't see a conflict there of Congress saying a citizen of the United States or of any of them. And then California is saying, but wait a minute, you don't get to be a citizen of California until you naturalize with us. I mean, some of these states back then, there were not a lot of people, and you wouldn't have enough people in some states to do, to support another level of naturalization within the state. That would be my guess. But so I wonder if, like all these other naturalization acts, I wonder how much this has been affected, because I'm looking at Wikipedia and there is a Naturalization Act of 1870. Bless you. Oh my God, it's late, isn't it?
Wow. You've mentioned earlier in our discussions, I don't know, half a dozen Supreme Court cases that said, well, you can be a citizen of the several state and you have citizenship, national citizenship, but you're not a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, you can be a citizen of California and not be a citizen of the United States.
A statutory citizen. You don't believe there's a difference between a constitutional citizen and a statutory citizen? I guess you say
I don't know what those definitions are. I'm talking about a citizen of Washington, D.C. and a citizen of California. You can be a citizen of California and not be a citizen of Washington, D.C., yet have all the benefits of being a citizen of Washington, D.C.
We're back to, I have an English degree, I am not an English degree.
Right.
That any alien being a free white person may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States or any of them on the following conditions and not otherwise. And be admitted. Yeah, so they're literally talking about, it says that any alien, that we need to look at that definition, which I'm taking to mean geographically, not from this, you know, dirt, arriving elsewhere, from elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm not worried about that. That's pretty straightforward.
Okay. So I can see where the California, through that treaty, would have the authority to do their own naturalization of people that were... Oh, no, never mind. That's all wrong.
California could do its own naturalization, but it didn't have the authority to trump to say to somebody, you don't have to go through federal naturalization, and you can just go straight through California. California doesn't have that authority. But the federal
government...
And
neither did any of the several states.
Right. But maybe I'm just guessing. I don't know this for sure. But let's say some of the several states decided that whatever the naturalization was decided on for Washington, D.C., that's good enough for us. And in practice, half of the states said whatever D.C. says is good. If you show up here, you're a citizen of our state, too. And then another half of the states said, no, that's not good enough for us. We want you to naturalize here formally. That statement, that Naturalization Act, doesn't preclude from that from happening.
Does the Constitution?
The Constitution doesn't preclude it, I don't think.
I thought the Constitution said that Congress will regulate naturalization.
Well, yeah, it is regulating naturalization. You have to go through Congress first. But they couldn't force the several states to accept citizens. That wording that where it says of the United States or any of them, I don't see it being a thing that says, okay, we've just negated California's, you can go ahead and naturalize there. It's formality only. It doesn't mean anything because we have the power to tell California that they can't run those courts. Like, in other words, if somebody didn't qualify for naturalization in California, I don't think Congress could come in and say, this person is a citizen of California because we said they are in this federal naturalization act. I don't read it that way. I read it more that, and the way the government was working back then, where the federal government was supposed to work with the states, which nobody alive today knows what that was like, that I would guess a bunch of states just allowed the federal government to handle that for them.
Yeah, I can see that possibly. So the whole thing that drove this whole conversation, if I come back to the beginning, was I don't see any clear evidence. I know it exists because I've done it. I've seen you do it. Todd's done it and so forth, Dane, about why postage is 3 cents in non-domestic mail. But if you had to explain to someone why, where's the evidence? How? Why? Where's the evidence?
I mean, for me, it's pretty convincing that nobody can conduct business under the Articles of Confederation. That there's no way to conduct business that way. Yet the Articles of Confederation, the authority for that still exists. It's not hard for me to explain that. A lot of people find it amazing that there was a government before the United States. But in the same fashion, if that's the case, if Articles of Confederation exists, but it's unoccupied, then the same thing happened when there was no longer a quorum for the United States. It got really muddy, but otherwise...
So you would say if someone said, no, they had the authority to continue without that official quorum in order to save the Union as it existed.
Well, they did have the authority and the obligation to try and preserve the Union the best they could. But there's the concentration of power, the way it went, there's no motivation to go bring it back the other way. All of a sudden, Congress has insane amounts of power that they never had before. And so who in power at that point would want to undo it? I mean, the suspended habeas corpus for years, and it was somebody who brought the case to the Supreme Court, and Congress quickly convened and then repealed habeas corpus, and the whole case just died. It was gone. It was just an insane concentration of power when that quorum was lost that served the federal powers. The states weren't getting along anymore. But I certainly am open. If somebody can show me why the post office is delivering the mail for 3 cents, other than the 37th Congress, that the reason behind that is the 37th Congress is set that postage rate for that area. When I say that area, I'm talking about the non-domestic mail that we mail today. And that ultimately that's the reason why. If somebody comes back and says, oh, it was because of this, that wouldn't change anything that I'm doing today. It would still show that it's outside of, regardless of what it is, it's outside of the USPS, which is a completely federal corporation today, that inherited the obligations of the Post Office Department.
Yeah, I'm not trying to say that. My desire is to have, for myself, as well as any others that I have to interact with, rather than just the envelope, to say, look, see, it came for 3 cents, to say, this is why. And it would also, for me, help better understand, okay, was it this de facto new flavor of government that established because of what happened at the Civil War and so forth, as you're indicating? Or, in fact, was it different in that the states continued, although with a lot of friction and so forth, but when I could easily just as much argue that, hey, in Federal Reserve got created, Federal Reserve notes got put in, we became enslaved and indentured because of that. At the same time, the birth certificate came around in 1913, 1916 time frame. Social Security just after that. Internal Revenue Code was created in 1920-something, 30-something, can't remember the date. All those things right around then. Postage also was still 3 cents at that time, and so forth. And it's not that it's going to change necessarily that I think you should go about your activity like you're doing now and freeing yourself from obligations, but it does change the context of how things came about, so that if you have to defend yourself, I think
actually the question you're asking, the only way to answer it is you have to dive in. Like, they're not doing general delivery mail here at the post office anymore. So I go in and I'll say, this is my theory and this is how I'm pushing it. And if they don't rebut it, then it's going to win. In other words, they'll like bad case law. I might win on bad case law.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm wrong, it really doesn't matter, because they do deliver the mail for 3 cents. And if somebody is going to get so hung up on why the mail is delivered for 3 cents before they do anything, I mean, there's so many things like that, that there's like, why do city limit signs not have a black border around them, yet rules do? Where did that come from? There's so many little details like that, that the overall thing is, I'm a citizen of California. I'm not going to accept government ID other than government ID I control. And hopefully a bunch of people working on this are going to figure it out. But I doubt you're going to find anything out there that will hard, fast say, here is exactly why the post office delivers mail for 3 cents. Because you're right, there's a bunch of different possibilities. You have the War Powers Act right after, that's never been repealed. What are all these other laws that came right after the Civil War?
Let me ask you real quick. The local post office where you used to be able to get general deliveries no longer doing it?
Yeah, I just found out people were sending me letters and they're getting them returned, and I go in to pick them up and they're not delivering it. So now I got to engage. They deliver all my 3 cent mail, but now I got to go and engage with the post office and find out why they're not delivering it. And I'm going to do it based on, they inherited the, it have nothing to do with the Civil War. That is a properly addressed letter that the post office department would have to deliver. And you guys inherited that liability in 1970. So that particular issue has nothing to do with postage or the Civil War or anything.
When you said that
way,
they deliver your 3 cent mail, you're saying that that's going to
When I send it to other people, no problem.
I got you.
And when people send non-domestic mail to me, I get it no problem. The only thing I have a problem with now is general delivery. Okay. And what they're saying at the post office is you only get that for 30 days.
Meaning 30 days in your life?
Yeah, you only get general delivery mail for 30 days in the United States Postal Service. So I have to show them that they inherited the obligation of the post office department letter.
Hold on. They tell you this verbally, the 30-day thing?
Yeah, it's in the code. You only get 30 days of general delivery mail, and that's it. That's all you get.
So let's back up. I do think you're saying, oh, I just have to show that they have the obligation from 1970, whatever that date is.
On the particular issue of delivering the mail for general delivery.
Yeah, okay, that I agree with. But if someone argued with, no, you need 46 cents on this, and you'll have to argue, one, the correct postage, and two, the domestic versus non-domestic thing.
So my argument is, you know my argument, and you know, if I'm wrong, great. I still end up with a letter getting delivered for 3 cents. If I'm wrong, I'd like to know what the correct thing is, but I don't see. It seems like an awful lot of effort over something that doesn't really matter. What matters about that is that the post office isn't the only game in town. They have to honor other jurisdiction as well. To me, the whole 3 cent non-domestic mail is just showing that there's another set of rules that they have to play by. And if I got it wrong on why specifically the 3 cent mail gets delivered, it has nothing to do with a quorum or anything. Although it's to me very clear that there was not a quorum.
Corey, I'm not hung up on whether it's 3 cents or 46 cents. But right. If you have to go to someone and you say you inherited the liabilities in 1970, okay?
Yeah.
Then and you're saying it should be 3 cents. Well, are they going to argue, well, wait a minute, 1970 postage was X. And so.
And then I go back and say, are you not going to, you know, recognize the 37th Congress? That's how I would do it. I haven't had to do that yet, but that's how I would do it. And if I'm wrong, the engagement is what will tell you. The engagement is is what will tell you. I mean, all of this is just kind of like, we're a whole bunch of people guessing.
See, what I'm trying to do is trying to take multiple aspects, postage, non-domestic mail, the passport, 14th Amendment, and so forth, and use multiple things and the timeline associated with it to better understand each of them and be able
to... So why do you think they deliver the 3 cent mail? Because of the 3,000 mile thing? Or why do you think they do it?
I can think of several scenarios that they might honor it for that, but I can't prove either one of them yet. And to me, it would be important in terms of possibly interpreting other things, such as the 14th Amendment, in terms of if it's because 1855 it was 3 cents, and then the new government was established from the Civil War.
But remember, people back then, it was way different. The mindset was way different. The mindset was if, like in California for the sales tax, it was, hey, we need some money. Can we enact a sales tax? And everybody said, yeah. The mindset of the people were, hey, the post office is broke. We need an extra 2 cents. Most of America was like, yeah, let's do it. That's how much we need to put in. And then they would put it back down to 3 cents again. There wasn't really the need to delineate, hey, you have an obligation to carry this for 3 cents. People weren't thinking that way back then. So, there was no income tax in, 1850? There was no IRS. Yet the way the IRS and the income tax and the Federal Reserve and everything else got into play was obviously deception, but playing on the good nature of the American people who want to participate in their government.
The federal government paid for most of the postage, the cost of postage.
Well, the post office is mandated to support itself. Did it get subsidies from the federal government? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm sure it did. Now, okay. Whether that was the de jure or de facto one, I don't know. Yeah. So if you're saying that the post office had to be self-sufficient, and then
from the very beginning it had to be self-sufficient. That was the whole mandate behind it.
So Congress never gave them a penny.
They might have given them some money to start up roads and get started. I don't know. But I know that the whole thing behind Benjamin Franklin making the post office self-sufficient is that it is the seat of government. If the entire government failed, the post office could continue to run without a government, that it had the mechanism in place to be able to feed itself. And the reason for that was they weren't real sure if this government was going to work. And the post office was so important that that's how it was designed, and it allowed for the regular people to get involved too. It didn't limit it to just government because it was being funded by government. Anybody could now send a letter in this mechanism and it would work. That was the whole thing with Benjamin Franklin, why he designed it that way. Let me see.
Well, they also delivered the news for free, newspaper for
right.
free.
Yeah.
So if you're right that the federal government, other than the startup, did not subsidize them whatsoever, then...
I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm saying that it was supposed to be funded itself. I've never seen anything that that the federal government, you know, as a matter of course, would provide funding for the post office department, because it was supposed to fund itself. And it even before that, it was called the something post. I forgot. It was called something else right before the post office department.
Let me jump in here real quick. If you look at that screenshot I just sent you, this is the highlights from Dane's lookup of the statutes at large.
Yeah.
And the first blue, do you have it in front of you, Tim?
Getting there.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
The first blue line, single rate letter, shall be the weight is 1/2 ounce, whatever that other term is, I'm not sure. But the second blue highlights, rate of postage on all domestic letters transmitted in the mails of the United States.
The mails of the United States was the parts in between the post offices. So if you had a drop letter that went to your neighbor down the street and didn't leave the jurisdiction of your local post office, it never entered the mails of the United States. That was drop mail.
Local, essentially.
Local.
So it's between the states.
Well, no, it was between post offices.
Post that's offices. When it okay.
Post offices. That's when it enters the mails of the United States.
Is when it goes between each post office. Okay, because
if it has to get on a wagon that the United States owned to deliver mail between, say, you know, Los Angeles and San Diego.
Yeah.
That means it's entered the mails of the United States.
Okay.
And those different postmaster positions were offices of profit, but they were like little businesses. They were, you know, that you guaranteed to make a decent living, whatever. And if you were able to develop, and they were encouraged postmasters to get people to send mail locally, because you could make money that way.
Get them to pay for something to be drop mailed.
Yeah, see, it says described as local or drop letters, not exceeding 1/2 ounce in weight, should be uniform at 2 cents.
Wait, I got to see where that part is. Hold on.
Section 23.
Yeah. Huh, but delivered to the post office, so who cares? Commonly described local or drop letters, not exceeding 1/2 ounce in weight. 2 cents.
So what's the difference? See, it says domestic in 22.
Yeah.
Well, the word domestic has gotten inverted lately. I mean, that's the
right.
problem.
Now, domestic is only in Washington, D.C. non-domestic is outside Washington, D.C.
It's like the word federal and national has just been inverted.
And domestic letters transmitted in the mails of the United States were letters that got onto a wagon that the United States, you know, property. Those were not postmaster positions. Those were just government post office positions that were centralized. You know, all of that was centralized. The local postmasters had power over their local post office. And if the letter never made it into the United States mails, then it was considered local or drop letter. And that's still the same. You can send a letter locally for 2 cents.
Yeah, I got to try that now. Interesting. Man, it takes a while for all this stuff to sink in. It's sad that there's that much of a matrix in front of the brain here. So it's right there, black and white. How many times have I looked at it, you know?
Well, I brought this up to Corey. This is 1868, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that would be after that there's no quorum.
Yeah.
Right.
So how's that differ than if this said it was 1861 or 1858?
Well, the idea behind a quorum is when it starts. So all the time in Congress, you get decisions and you get things done once Congress is started. So when did the quorum get lost?
Sometime in 61 or 62.
Cena die?
Yeah. 1861. So let me see what this is. War and Emergency War Powers Acts. Yeah, 1861. So, you know, I honestly don't know how to reconcile that. For now, I use it to show the jurisdiction. And I suppose if the post office stops delivering the mail, then, you know, I'll have to figure out why it is from a better footing that they had to. My understanding was the 37th Congress. And I'll find out from Dane what he says. I know he's brought up things about Washington, D.C. being incorporated, but, you know.
So if I think the implications of what you're asking, Tim, are that if this was when Congress was seen to die, then it's not about the several states because they're no longer dealing with them. It's all corporate. I'm not quite sure what the ramifications are. What does it matter?
Right.
Part of this all came about because, you know, Corey, you say, well, the birth certificate's a 14th Amendment person. And
it is. Are you saying,
this is part of what I'm trying to rectify is I don't know if I believe the birth certificate. He's definitely a property of D.C., and he's domiciled in D.C., and he's an artificial person. But how does that make him a 14th Amendment person?
Because it's a citizen of the United States.
But that was ratified by the people of the several states, and they couldn't make a citizen of the United States. And you're saying, no, that D.C. already made a citizen of the United States. And
right.
Right. There was just no protections. The 14th Amendment, all it did was force the states, rather than acting on their good behavior, it forced the states to honor certain protections, like more formalized citizenship of the United States.
Let's jump back to that word, that phrase you brought up to him about, was it Borden or which Greenberg, about the declaring the United States citizen. What was that one? What was that language?
I'll find it in a second. But I can see your viewpoint there, Corey.
Because I mean, if I'm wrong, I don't have any skin in the game on a 14th Amendment citizen. Like, I don't care what it is. Let's say it's not a 14th Amendment person. I can show there on the birth certificate that the mother and father are not married, and this is a common law country. So in the several states, you can't be a citizen. I mean, that's antecedent to the United States. That theory.
I'm sorry, if the parents on the birth certificate aren't married.
Yeah, if the child,
so the person on the birth certificate cannot be a citizen of the of one of the several states.
There's no way it can't. You can't. You're a ward of the state. If you're a bastard, you're a ward of the state. That's antecedent to the United States. You can't get into what's that?
To DC. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's antecedent to the existence of the colonies. I mean, you go back to Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, that idea that bastards cannot be citizens goes back in common law long before the colonies were here.
But they would be the ward of which state? The federal state or the several state?
It doesn't matter. They're a ward of their property of somebody. You could be a ward of California. You could be a ward of the United States. You're not a citizen. You're not, you know, it doesn't matter the jurisdiction. You're not a citizen. You're below the level of a citizen. You can't ever be a citizen if you're a bastard.
But meanwhile, the birth certificate, which you are saying is a 14th Amendment United States citizen, is a bastard. So it is
right.
A citizen.
Well, it's a 14th Amendment citizen. There is no common law in the federal government. So
okay, it's critical.
The federal government, that you can be a citizen of the federal government and be a bastard because there's no common law there.
So you're one of the can somebody whose parents weren't married then be a citizen, one of the domiciled in California 1849?
No, that's why it was such a big deal to have the family Bible. And you put in when you're, when you were conceived, like that conception date was important because it would denote being conceived after your parents were married, and you'd be able to prove that in the Bible.
Oh man, that's a huge revelation right there, dude. That's wow.
Yeah, and that's common law. In other words, a lot of people got away with being bastards and not ever being outed. You know, like. Long time ago, people were gay and you would never talk about it. If you were a bastard, you would never, ever let that out. If you could get away without being that way, then you would. So I'm sure lots and lots of people were citizens of the several states, even though they were bastards, but they hid it. If you were challenged on it, and, you know, I'm not aware of anyone being challenged on it, but... certainly, like Leonardo da Vinci, he tried for a long time to get his dad to give him his name so he didn't have to take the name of the city.
So if two people today ignorantly claim that they're the birth certificate and they're domiciled in D.C., they get married, get a marriage license and stuff, then have a child, then that child says, "No, wait a minute. No. I was born on the land in Illinois or California or Iowa. I'm a citizen of one of the several states." And go through these motions and all, and then someone says, well, "Wait a minute, who were your parents? Show proof of that you're not a bastard."
Well, I think it actually works the other way. You have to show proof that you are a bastard. So, like in Leonardo da Vinci's case, in order to show you weren't a bastard, you would have to get your father to sign off and give you his name. And I believe that was through the, if I'm correct, it was through a notarial act or through a Bible back then. Now,
I'm
let's
sorry,
say
you had, you had to prove that you weren't a bastard or that you were a bastard.
That you weren't. So if you were going to take a name, it would be your father would give you your name. And in other words, let's say, Tim, you say you're a citizen of one of the several states. And I come in and say you're a bastard. I would have the burden of proof to show that you weren't married. I'd have to come up with a couple of people who knew that you weren't together. Somehow you admitted it, or your parents weren't together, your parents weren't ever married, or something like that. If you had documents to show that you're a citizen of one of the several states, and I want to say you're not based on you not having proper parentage, then that burden of proof, I believe, is going to be on me.
Okay, so let's say that you could go, my parents got married in Maryland. You go to Maryland, get the court records, and say, well, look, here's their birth certificates, and here they got married by the state through a marriage license and so forth. So,
Well, there's all the issues right there. If you say that you got married and you have a marriage license.
No, not me, my parents.
I mean, your parents had a marriage license, and you're going to use all of that as evidence, and then they show the birth certificate, that the birth certificate is the product of that, then you're a bastard. You're going to be stuck in that federal citizenship. You can't become a citizen of one of the several states with the birth certificate. In common law, there's no way. Even if you, because that's the evidence that your parents signed.
Because the birth certificate has the data.
It's got the mother's maiden name. It says first, middle, last, and it's got a witness that, you know, your mom's maiden name and your father's name, and the license to get married meant two people who weren't allowed to get married otherwise are now being given a license to get married. It's not going to ever rise to the level. It's permanent residency, but that's voluntary in this country. It's not like in other countries how you can't ever escape from that. In this country, it's voluntary because it's pretending all of this is happening in Washington, D.C. The reality is different. You just can't use those documents to show you're a citizen of one of the several states.
Oh, no, I didn't plan up. I'm saying that the person that wants to claim I am a bastard would go get those documents.
Right, yeah. If you want to claim to be a bastard, you go get those documents.
Yes. No. Not me. My adversary.
Well, then they have to prove that's you. And like with the birth certificate, I'd say, but that's not me. And I can identify the difference in the birth certificate because it's a first, middle, last name construction, and I have a given and family name. That's the Christian name. That's somebody else. The same name, you know, different title.
And then you have a Bible to back up that, or you don't even need that? Just say, I don't need to prove that.
Well, I haven't been through it, but you would have a Bible. I mean, a family Bible was a very important thing.
Right, but what if you don't have that? I mean, you know, it's 2012.
Well, now you don't have that, but nobody's arguing the term bastard. A judge would recognize it, I'm sure. I recognize it, so I'm not going to identify myself as that person. Whether it's a 14th Amendment person, whether it's property of the government or anything, I know my parents were joined in holy matrimony from being told that by other people who were witness to it. Just because they signed paperwork along with the government at the time doesn't mean that that paperwork identifies me.
Right. Yeah, and the other thing is there's no common law court. So,
well, that they're all common law courts. They're just being run statutorily.
Well, they could not. Actually, I think I've even heard some of the courts say, I've seen some videos of a court case, and the judge, actually, it's an audio. The judge said, I think it was maybe in Utah. I can't remember. In such and such time frame, there are no common law crimes in this state. There's no such thing. This is not a common law court. There is no common law crime.
There is no common law court in this state. What year did they say that?
In the last 10 years, I would assume 5
well,
years.
Well, yeah. I mean, when I walked into the court, they said, you know, you have to have a license in this state. What they're referring to in that court is
the federal state.
The federal state, and there is no common law in the federal government. It's not a common law area. They're absolutely
right.
Telling the truth.
So my point is your adversary can't rely upon that form of attack, that you're a bastard. Then you'd be admitting, if I'm a bastard, then you're admitting that I'm not in your jurisdiction, and there's no crime that you can process me in because I'm not in your jurisdiction. So It's immature whether I'm a bastard or not. You just admitted that I'm not that. I'm not a 14th, or I'm not the birth certificate. So, do you see what I mean?
Lost. No, I got lost on that.
If they wanted to argue, if I said, yeah, I'm a citizen of the several state in Illinois, and they said, no, you're not. And they said, well, you're a bastard. And that, you know.
Like, proven by the birth certificate, because you're. This is what the birth certificate says.
Okay.
No, not proven. Proven by the parent's birth certificate.
Right.
And I say, well, I'm not that person. And they say, if they're trying to rely upon a common law.
I see what you're saying.
They can't.
Common law principle or common
principle,
law. Yeah.
They can't because they're not even in a common law state.
Right. Yeah. Except, no, they do. They rely on common hyphen law. The IRS has it right in their code. Watch. They do what's called common hyphen law, and then they'll say, they're not going to say the word hyphen, but then they'll say common law in this state, blah, 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 blah. And if you read it, it's common hyphen law.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Common law.
Say that.
Look
search...
at common law employee. Just type in, I think it's common law employee. You'll find IRS. Yeah, it's common hyphen law employee. They change it by adding the hyphen. So now if you go into court and you hear a judge say, oh, no, under it says right here on the IRS website, under common hyphen law rules.
Can you Skype the link to me, please?
Yeah. Send it right now. Oops.
Under common law rules, anyone who performs services for you is your employee if you can control what will be done and how it will be done.
And we know the IRS is not a common law entity. Mm-hmm. But if you went into court, they're going to talk about a common law employee. In a jurisdiction that has no common law.
Yeah, it's a different term.
And the whole common law rules, I mean, that's kind of an oxymoron,
Exactly.
Law rules.
But if you're in court and you hear a judge say in a ruling that common law rules, this is an employee or whatever, you'd think, oh my God, there's a common law court. But you have to, it's way more nuanced than that.
So circle back to what Tim was arguing, though, is I'm the adversary. I'm trying to prove that you are a bastard because it helps me put you in this hole of you can't be one of the citizens of the several states, right?
Right.
And what I think Tim is saying is that if you're GovCo and you're trying to get you out of being domiciled in California 1849, then to rely on proving you are a bastard is a common law edict. And I think if I was one of the people of the several states of California 1849, I'd have standing then in common law to try and prove it. But if I'm GovCo, I don't have standing to try and prove it.
No, I think GovCo does have standing because if you're not properly born, if you are a bastard, then you're a ward of the state. And right now the federal government's running everything. So I suppose, it's a ways out there, but if I were in a position where the IRS is saying that I'm a bastard, or anybody is saying, trying to get me out of my state citizenship jurisdiction, is saying I'm a bastard, I would take that very seriously. I would really look at that because that's exactly what they would do to show that I'm not a citizen of California.
Hmm. And what Tim, I think, was asserting was that because that your bastard status matters, or not only matters really within common law, then how does the entity that there is no common law in the United States, how can they use it to their advantage or not?
Well, because if they can prove you're a bastard, then you're no longer a citizen and you would be a ward of the state subject to all the rules of employees the way our government's set up now.
Then it's which state is it? Award of the one of the several states, because you're domiciled in California 1849.
It doesn't matter because California 1849 is being run. All those offices are being run by 14th Amendment employees. And if you're a government official, or if you're a ward of the state, then all these laws that only apply to the government and not the people of California all of a sudden would apply to bastards.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough Rubicon to cross because it's such a the whole thing's based in common law. By that I mean the statushood of bastard matters in common law.
Right.
But its result of its how it matters in common law is being used to enslave you in statutory law.
In other words, if I went to the court and identified myself on the person as a person on the birth certificate and wanted to claim to be a citizen of California, I don't think they would ever mention this, but my guess is the judge would look at it and say, you can't be. You're identifying yourself, you know, as a bastard. If the birth certificate got onto the court record and the judge could see it.
Right.
But it, let me ask this. Maybe this is a nuance, but maybe important one. It says mother's maiden name, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm incorrect, but doesn't maiden refer to her name prior to being married?
Exactly. And she's having a baby.
So it doesn't prove that you're a bastard.
Well, yeah, I've thought about this too, Tim. You're a maiden when you're not married.
Right.
That's what maiden
mother's is. Maiden name. It means your mother's not married. Your parents are not married.
Maiden
it's not
means
it's not prior to marriage. It's both, but it's being used. Okay.
Yeah. It's used as like what was your maiden name every day. That's it. But if you look at that document, plain language, it says mother's maiden name.
Yeah. And like a maiden race for horse racing, you know, you've never won a race. You've never, it's, you're still a maiden.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Iron Maiden.
Guys, I am wiped out.
Yeah,
man.
Likewise. Yeah, I've got a lot of notes. This has been very helpful, though, and gives you more background on what you've typed up, Tim, and sent. So,
I think it's good to poke holes in it to find, you know, find areas that don't work.
Yeah.
But here, did you see that link about the for Executive Department, State of California, executive order?
Yeah, let me pull that up real quick here.
The state of California, I mean, it says the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, applicable to the state of California by the 14th Amendment, and Article 1, Section 19 of the California Constitution guarantee that private property should not be taken for public use without just compensation. You have to go to the 14th Amendment to get to the Fifth Amendment first. That's because California, as we know it today, is a 14th Amendment person.
Did you see the link, Tim?
I have it now, yeah.
That's crazy. Whereas the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, this is an executive order from the governor, huh? 1989.
That's 1969, isn't it?
Oh, is it 69? Okay, yeah.
So this was 10 years after ratification of the 14th Amendment. Maybe it is 1989. It is 1989. I just zoomed it way in.
Okay. I was kind of going off that guy, the governor, his name is really weird to spell. I was checking him out on Wikipedia.
Duke Majan. I remember Governor Duke Majan, so it must have been 1989.
Yeah, D-E-U-K-M-E-J-I-A-N.
So,
and he was the attorney general. When was the 14th Amendment ratified in California?
1959.
Okay. Yeah, he was the attorney general for 5 years.
They already had the state of California, as far as it being a franchise of the federal government and a 14th Amendment person, that existed. Prior to the ratification of the 14th Amendment in California.
So, interesting. I mean, could this order also apply to a non-14th Amendment entity? Why can't a non-14th Amendment, I mean, is a state...
All it's saying is the Fifth Amendment, the way it applies to this corporate state of California, you have to go to the 14th Amendment first. Likewise, if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, you have to go to the 14th Amendment first before you get to your Second Amendment rights or your Fifth Amendment rights or anything else. But, like von Valkenburg v. Brown says, if you're not a 14th Amendment person, then you're covered by the Constitution directly.
So let me bring this up. I said, here's a court case in 1907 says natural, you must be a natural person to be a 14th Amendment citizen. And you say, okay, all you have to do is hold that, hold the office, a person holding the office. Right?
Okay, well, I'm sure that that has changed as far as 14th Amendment person, because there are, I mean, corporations are 14th Amendment citizens now. With a right to free speech. And that's as recent as 2010 for, you know, the, what was that one?
United something. Or
People,
other.
People's United.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's, the next time we, take up a conference call.
Or Citizens United. That's what it
Citizens
was.
Citizens United. Yeah. Let's riff off of this, executive order and start from there to.
So, yeah. That's kind of my key point is help me understand how in 1907, a corporation did not qualify as a 14th Amendment person.
Because most corporations in 1907 were...
private corporations?
No, they were under the authority of the state, and the 14th Amendment has nothing to do with the state. Once the states all be... Once the state, like, at least in California, it used to be you'd get your corporation in California 1849. Even though California 1879 was running it, the authority for your corporation, your local corporation here, came from California. Now you still get your corporation from the state of California, but it's the federal side
extension
of government.
Of, yeah.
And that is a 14th Amendment person.
Your federal ID number, your FIN.
Yeah. Get your EIN number, everything else, but... In 1912, the nature of the country was different, so a corporation could not be a 14th Amendment person if it wasn't federal. If it was a state corporation, then the 14th Amendment wouldn't apply.
And but would the Fifth Amendment apply to it?
Well, I doubt the Fifth Amendment would apply to the corporation because that was intended for... you know, the people of the several states at that point. Mm-hmm. So there, it might be property rules, like it would apply to whoever owned the corporation. They would be able to invoke Fifth Amendment rights that the corporation is their property.
There you go. Okay. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Gentlemen, this has been real. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Tim.
All right, man.
And, all right, have a good night, all.
Check it in with both of you soon. Take care.
Cool. Good night. Thanks.